Chapter 22. Fourth Estate. Nothing is harder than living with a secret that can't be spoken. Lying to strangers about a cover identity or concealing the fact that your office is under the world's most top-secret pineapple field might sound like it qualifies, but at least you're part of a team. Though your work may be secret, it's a shared secret, and therefore a shared burden. There is misery, but also laughter. When you have a real secret, though, that you can't share with anyone, even the laughter is a lie. I could talk about my concerns, but never about where they were leading me. To the day I die, I'll remember explaining to my colleagues how our work was being applied to violate the oaths we had sworn to uphold, and their verbal shrug in response. What can you do about it? I hated that question, its sense of resignation, its sense of defeat. But it still felt valid enough that I had to ask myself, well, what? When the answer presented itself, I decided to become a whistleblower. Yet to breathe to Lindsay, the love of my life, even a word about that decision, would have put our relationship to an even crueler test than saying nothing. Not wishing to cause her any more harm than I was already resigned to causing, I kept silent. And in my silence, I was alone. I thought that solitude and isolation would be easy for me, or at least easier than it had been for my predecessors in the whistleblowing world. Hadn't each step of my life served as a kind of preparation? Hadn't I gotten used to being alone after all those years spent hushed and spellbound in front of a screen? I'd been the solo hacker, the night shift harbor master, the keeper of the keys in an empty office. But I was human, too. And the lack of companionship was hard. Each day was haunted by struggle as I tried and failed to reconcile the moral and the legal, my duties and my desires. I had everything I'd ever wanted, love, family, and success far beyond what I ever deserved. And I lived in Eden, amid plentiful trees, only one of which was forbidden to me. The easiest thing should have been to follow the rules. And even if I was already reconciled to the dangers of my decision, I wasn't yet adjusted to the role. After all, who was I to put this information in front of the American public? Who'd elected me the president of secrets? The information I intended to disclose about my country's secret regime of mass surveillance was so explosive, yet so technical, that I was as scared of being doubted as I was of being misunderstood. That was why my first decision, after resolving to go public, was to go public with documentation. The way to reveal a secret program might have been merely to describe its existence, but the way to reveal programmatic secrecy was to describe its workings. This required documents, the agency's actual files, as many as necessary to expose the scope of the abuse, though I knew that disclosing even one PDF would be enough to earn me prison. The threat of government retribution against any entity or platform to which I made the disclosure led me to briefly consider self-publishing. That would have been the most convenient and safest method, just collecting the documents that best communicated my concerns and posting them online, as they were, then circulating a link. Ultimately, one of my reasons for not pursuing this course had to do with authentication. Scores of people post classified secrets to the internet every day, many of them about time travel technologies and aliens. I didn't want my own revelations, which were fairly incredible already, to get lumped in with the outlandish and lost among the crazy. It was clear to me then, from the earliest stages of the process, that I required, and that the public deserved, some person or institution to vouch for the veracity of the documents. I also wanted a partner to vet the potential hazards posed by the revelation of classified information, and to help explain that information by putting it in technological and legal context. I trusted myself to present the problems with surveillance, and even to analyze them, but I'd have to trust others to solve them. Regardless of how wary of institutions I might have been by this point, I was far warier of trying to act like one myself. Cooperating with some type of media organization would defend me against the worst accusations of rogue activity and correct for whatever biases I had, whether they were conscious or unconscious, personal or professional. I didn't want any political opinion of mine to prejudice anything with regard to the presentation or reception of the disclosures. After all, in a country in which everyone was being surveilled, no issue was less partisan than surveillance. In retrospect, I have to credit at least some of my desire to find ideological filters to Lindsay's improving influence. Lindsay had spent years patiently instilling in me the lesson that my interests and concerns weren't always hers, and certainly weren't always the world's, and that just because I shared my knowledge didn't mean that anyone had to share my opinion. Not everybody who was opposed to invasions of privacy might be ready to adopt 256-bit encryption standards or drop off the internet entirely. An illegal act that disturbed one person as a violation of the Constitution might upset another person as a violation of their privacy or of that of their spouse or children. Lindsay was my key to unlocking this truth, that diverse motives and approaches can only improve the chances of achieving common goals. She, without even knowing it, gave me the confidence to conquer my qualms and reach out to other people. But which people? Who? It might be hard to remember or even to imagine, but at the time when I first considered coming forward, the whistleblower's forum of choice was WikiLeaks. Back then, it operated in many respects like a traditional publisher, albeit one that was radically skeptical of state power. WikiLeaks regularly joined up with leading international publications like The Guardian, The New York Times, Der Spiegel, Le Monde, and El País to publish the documents provided by its sources. The work that these partner news organizations accomplished over the course of 2010 and 2011 suggested to me that WikiLeaks was most valuable as a go-between that connected sources with journalists and as a firewall that preserved sources' anonymity. WikiLeaks' practices changed following its publication of disclosures by U.S. Army Private Chelsea Manning. Huge caches of U.S. military field logs pertaining to the Iraq and Afghan wars, information about detainees in Guantanamo Bay, along with U.S. diplomatic cables. Due to the governmental backlash and media controversy surrounding the site's redaction of the Manning materials, WikiLeaks decided to change course and publish future leaks as they received them, pristine and unredacted. This switch to a policy of total transparency meant that publishing with WikiLeaks would not meet my needs. Effectively, it would have been the same for me as self-publishing, a route I'd already rejected as insufficient. I knew that the story the NSA documents told about a global system of mass surveillance deployed in the deepest secrecy was a difficult one to understand, a story so tangled and technical that I was increasingly convinced that it could not be presented all at once in a document dump, but only by the patient and careful work of journalists, undertaken in the best scenario I could conceive of, with the support of multiple independent press institutions. Though I felt some relief once I'd resolved to disclose directly to journalists, I still had some lingering reservations. Most of them involved my country's most prestigious publications, particularly America's newspaper of record, the New York Times. Whenever I thought about contacting the Times, I found myself hesitating. While the paper had shown some willingness to displease the U.S. government with its WikiLeaks reporting, I couldn't stop reminding myself of its earlier conduct involving an important article on the government's warrantless wiretapping program by Eric Lischbrau and James Risen. Those two journalists, by combining information from Justice Department whistleblowers with their own reporting, had managed to uncover one aspect of Stellar Wind, the NSA's original recipe post-9/11 surveillance initiative, and had produced a fully written, edited, and fact-checked article about it, ready to go to press by mid-2004. It was at this point that the paper's editor-in-chief, Bill Keller, ran the article past the government as part of a courtesy process whose typical purpose is for a publication's editorial staff to have a chance to assess the government's arguments as to why the publication of certain information might endanger national security. In this case, as in most cases, the government refused to provide a specific reason, but implied that one existed and that it was classified too. The Bush administration told Keller and the paper's publisher, Arthur Sulzberger, without providing any evidence, that the Times would be emboldening America's enemies and enabling terror if it went public with the information that the government was wiretapping American citizens without a warrant. Unfortunately, the paper allowed itself to be convinced and spiked the article. Lischblau and Risen's reporting finally ran, but over a year later, in December 2005, and only after Risen pressured the paper by announcing that the material was included in a book of his that was about to be released. Had that article run when it was originally written, it might well have changed the course of the 2004 election. If the Times, or any paper, did something similar to me, if it took my revelations, reported on them, submitted the reporting for review, and then suppressed its publication, I'd be sunk. Given the likelihood of my identification as the source, it would be tantamount to turning me in before any revelations were brought to the public. If I couldn't trust a legacy newspaper, could I trust any institution? Why even bother? I hadn't signed up for any of this. I had just wanted to screw around with computers and maybe do some good for my country along the way. I had a lease and a lover, and my health was improved. Every stop sign on my commute I took as advice to stop this voluntary madness. My head and heart were in conflict, with the only constant being the desperate hope that somebody else, somewhere else, would figure it out on their own. After all, wasn't journalism about following the breadcrumbs and connecting the dots? What else did reporters do all day besides tweet? I knew at least two things about the denizens of the Fourth Estate. They competed for scoops, and they knew very little about technology. It was this lack of expertise or even interest in tech that largely caused journalists to miss two events that stunned me during the course of my fact-gathering about mass surveillance. The first was the NSA's announcement of the construction of a vast new data facility in Bluffdale, Utah. The agency called it the Massive Data Repository, until somebody with a knack for PR realized the name might be tough to explain if it ever got out. So it was renamed the Mission Data Repository, because as long as you don't change the acronym, you don't have to change all the briefing slides. The MDR was projected to contain a total of 4 25,000-square-foot halls filled with servers. It could hold an immense amount of data, basically a rolling history of the entire planet's pattern of life, insofar as life can be understood through the connection of payments to people, people to phones, phones to calls, calls to networks, and the synoptic array of internet activity moving along those networks' lines. The only prominent journalist who seemed to notice the announcement was James Bamford, who wrote about it for Wired in March 2012. There were a few follow-ups in the non-tech press, but none of them furthered the reporting. No one asked what, to me at least, were the most basic questions. Why does any government agency, let alone an intelligence agency, need that much space? What data and how much of it do they really intend to store there and for how long? Because there was simply no reason to build something to those specs unless you were planning on storing absolutely everything forever. Here was, to my mind, the corpus delicti, the plain-as-day corroboration of a crime, in a gigantic concrete bunker surrounded by barbed wire and guard towers, sucking up a city's worth of electricity from its own power grid in the middle of the Utah desert. And no one was paying attention. The second event happened 1 year later, in March 2013, 1 week after Clapper lied to Congress and Congress gave him a pass. A few periodicals had covered that testimony, though they merely regurgitated Clapper's denial that the NSA collected bulk data on Americans. But no so-called mainstream publication at all covered a rare public appearance by Ira Gus Hunt, the chief technology officer of the CIA. I'd known Gus slightly from my Dell stint with the CIA. He was one of our top customers, and every vendor loved his apparent inability to be discreet. He'd always tell you more than he was supposed to. For sales guys, he was like a bag of money with a mouth. Now he was appearing as a special guest speaker at a civilian tech event in New York called the GigaOM Structure Data Conference. Anyone with $40 could go to it. The major talks, such as Gus's, were streamed for free live online. The reason I'd made sure to catch his talk was that I'd just read, through internal NSA channels, that the CIA had finally decided on the disposition of its cloud contract. It had refused my old team at Dell and turned down HP, too, instead signing a 10-year, $600 million cloud development and management deal with Amazon. I had no negative feelings about this. Actually, at this juncture, I was pleased that my work wasn't going to be used by the agency. I was just curious, from a professional standpoint, whether Gus might obliquely address this announcement and offer any insight into why Amazon had been chosen, since rumors were going around that the proposal process had been rigged in Amazon's favor. I got insight, certainly, but of an unexpected kind. I had the opportunity of witnessing the highest-ranking technical officer at the CIA stand on stage in a rumpled suit and brief a crowd of uncleared normies and, via the internet, the uncleared world, about the agency's ambitions and capacities. As his presentation unfolded and he alternated bad jokes with an even worse command of PowerPoint, I grew more and more incredulous. "At the CIA," he said, "we fundamentally try to collect everything and hang on to it forever." As if that wasn't clear enough, he went on. "It is nearly within our grasp to compute on all human-generated information." He was reading from his slide deck, ugly words in an ugly font illustrated with the government's signature four-color clip art. There were a few journalists in the crowd, apparently, though it seemed as if almost all of them were from specialty tech government publications like Federal Computer Week. It was telling that Gus stuck around for a Q&A toward the conclusion of his presentation. Rather, it wasn't quite a Q&A, but more like an auxiliary presentation offered directly to the journalists. He must have been trying to get something off his chest, and it wasn't just his clown tie. Gus told the journalists that the agency could track their smartphones, even when they were turned off, that the agency could surveil every single one of their communications. Remember, this was a crowd of domestic journalists, American journalists, and the way that Gus said could came off as has, does, and will. He perorated in a distinctly disturbed and disturbing manner, at least for a CIA high priest. "Technology is moving faster than government or law can keep up. It's moving faster than you can keep up. You should be asking the question of what are your rights and who owns your data." I was floored. Anyone more junior than Gus who had given a presentation like this would have been wearing orange by the end of the day. Coverage of Gus's confession ran only in the Huffington Post. But the performance itself lived on at YouTube, where it still remains, at least at the time of this writing, 6 years later. The last time I checked, it had 313 views, a dozen of them mine. The lesson I took from this was that for my disclosures to be effective, I had to do more than just hand some journalists some documents, more even than help them interpret the documents. I had to become their partner, to provide the technological training and tools to help them do their reporting accurately and safely. Taking this course of action would mean giving myself over totally to one of the capital crimes of intelligence work. Whereas other spies have committed espionage, sedition, and treason, I would be aiding and abetting an act of journalism. The perverse fact is that legally, those crimes are virtually synonymous. American law makes no distinction between providing classified information to the press in the public interest and providing it, even selling it, to the enemy. The only opinion I've ever found to contradict this came from my first indoctrination into the IC. There, I was told that it was, in fact, slightly better to offer secrets for sale to the enemy than to offer them for free to a domestic reporter. A reporter will tell the public, whereas an enemy is unlikely to share its prize, even with its allies. Given the risks I was taking, I needed to identify people I could trust who were also trusted by the public. I needed reporters who were diligent yet discreet, independent yet reliable. They would need to be strong enough to challenge me on the distinctions between what I suspected and what the evidence proved, and to challenge the government when it falsely accused their work of endangering lives. Above all, I had to be sure that whoever I picked wouldn't ultimately cave to power when put under pressure that was certain to be like nothing they or I had ever experienced before. I cast my net so widely as to imperil the mission, but widely enough to avoid a single point of failure, the New York Times problem. One journalist, one publication, even one country of publication wouldn't be enough, because the U.S. government had already demonstrated its willingness to stifle such reporting. Ideally, I'd give each journalist their own set of documents simultaneously, leaving me with none. This would shift the focus of scrutiny to them and ensure that even if I were arrested, the truth would still get out. As I narrowed down my list of potential partners, I realized I'd been going about this all wrong, or just wastefully. Instead of trying to select the journalists on my own, I should have been letting the system that I was trying to expose select them for me. My best partners, I decided, would be journalists whom the national security state had already targeted. Laura Poitras I knew as a documentarian, primarily concerned with America's post-9/11 foreign policy. Her film, My Country, My Country, depicted the 2005 Iraqi national elections that were conducted under and frustrated by the U.S. occupation. She had also made The Program about the NSA cryptanalyst William Binney, who had raised objections through proper channels about Trailblazer, the predecessor of Stellar Wind, only to be accused of leaking classified information, subjected to repeated harassment, and arrested at gunpoint in his home, though never charged. Laura herself had been frequently harassed by the government because of her work, repeatedly detained and interrogated by border agents whenever she traveled in or out of the country. Glenn Greenwald, I knew, as a civil liberties lawyer turned columnist, initially for Salon, where he was one of the few who wrote about the unclassified version of the NSA IG's report back in 2009, and later for the U.S. edition of The Guardian. I liked him because he was skeptical and argumentative, the kind of man who'd fight with the devil, and when the devil wasn't around, fight with himself. Though Ewan McCaskill, of the British edition of The Guardian, and Bart Gellman of The Washington Post would later prove stalwart partners and patient guides to the journalistic wilderness, I found my earliest affinity with Laura and Glenn. Perhaps because they weren't merely interested in reporting on the IC, but had personal stakes in understanding the institution. The only hitch was getting in touch. Unable to reveal my true name, I contacted the journalists under a variety of identities, disposable masks worn for a time and then discarded. The first of these was Cincinnatus, after the legendary farmer who became a Roman consul and then voluntarily relinquished his power. That was followed by Citizen Four, a handle that some journalists took to mean that I considered myself the fourth dissident employee in the NSA's recent history, after Binney and his fellow trailblazer whistleblowers J. Kirk Weeb and Ed Loomis, though the triumvirate I actually had in mind consisted of Thomas Drake, who disclosed the existence of Trailblazer to journalists, and Daniel Ellsberg and Anthony Russo, whose disclosure of the Pentagon Papers helped expose the deceptions of the Vietnam War and bring it to an end. The final name I chose for my correspondence was Verax, Latin for Speaker of Truth, in the hopes of proposing an alternative to the model of a hacker called Mendax, Speaker of Lies, the pseudonym of the young man who'd grow up to become WikiLeaks' Julian Assange. You can't really appreciate how hard it is to stay anonymous online until you've tried to operate as if your life depended on it. Most of the communication systems set up by the IC have a single basic aim. The observer of a communication must not be able to discern the identities of those involved or in any way attribute them to an agency. This is why the IC calls these exchanges non-attributable. The pre-internet spycraft of anonymity is famous, mostly from TV and the movies. A safe house address coded in bathroom stall graffiti, for instance, or scrambled into the abbreviations of a classified ad. Or think of the Cold War's dead drops, the chalk marks on mailboxes signaling that a secret package was waiting inside a particular hollowed-out tree in a public park. The modern version might be fake profiles trading fake chats on a dating site, or, more commonly, just a superficially innocuous app that leaves superficially innocuous messages on a superficially innocuous Amazon server secretly controlled by the CIA. What I wanted, however, was something even better than that, something that required none of that exposure and none of that budget. I decided to use somebody else's internet connection. I wish that were simply a matter of going to a McDonald's or Starbucks and signing on to their Wi-Fi. But those places have CCTV and receipts and other people, memories with legs. Moreover, every wireless device from a phone to a laptop has a globally unique identifier called an MAC, Machine Address Code, which it leaves on record with every access point it connects to, a forensic marker of its user's movements. So I didn't go to McDonald's or Starbucks. I went driving. Specifically, I went war driving, which is when you convert your car into a roving Wi-Fi sensor. For this, you need a laptop, a high-powered antenna, and a magnetic GPS sensor, which can be slapped atop the roof. Power is provided by the car or by a portable battery, or else by the laptop itself. Everything you need can fit into a backpack. I took along a cheap laptop running Tails, which is a Linux-based amnesiac operating system, meaning it forgets everything when you turn it off and starts fresh when you boot it up again, with no logs or memory traces of anything ever done on it. Tails allowed me to easily spoof or disguise the laptop's MAC. Whenever it connected to a network, it left behind the record of some other machine, in no way associable with mine. Usefully enough, Tails also had built-in support for connecting to the anonymizing Tor network. At nights and on weekends, I drove around what seemed like the entire island of Oahu, letting my antenna pick up the pulses of each Wi-Fi network. My GPS sensor tagged each access point with the location at which it was noticed, thanks to a mapping program I used called Kismet. What resulted was a map of the invisible networks we pass by every day without even noticing, a scandalously high percentage of which had either no security at all or security I could trivially bypass. Some of the networks required more sophisticated hacking. I'd briefly jam a network, causing its legitimate users to be booted offline. In their attempt to reconnect, they'd automatically rebroadcast their authentication packets, which I could intercept and effectively decipher into passwords that would let me log on just like any other authorized user. With this network map in hand, I'd drive around Oahu like a madman, trying to check my email to see which of the journalists had replied to me. Having made contact with Laura Poitras, I'd spend much of the evening writing to her, sitting behind the wheel of my car at the beach, filching the Wi-Fi from a nearby resort. Some of the journalists I'd chosen needed convincing to use encrypted email, which back in 2012 was a pain. In some cases, I had to show them how, so I'd upload tutorials, sitting in my idling car in a parking lot, availing myself of the network of a library, or of a school, or of a gas station, or of a bank, which had horrifyingly poor protections. The point was not to create any patterns. Atop the parking garage of a mall, secure in the knowledge that the moment I closed the lid of my laptop, my secret was safe, I'd draft manifestos explaining why I'd gone public, but then delete them. And then I'd try writing emails to Lindsay, only to delete them too. I just couldn't find the words.